Okay, very good. So I'm going to start with an explanation of that title that will come towards the end of the shiur. But I have to give a little shout out to Rabbi Benjamin Blech, who I once heard him give that title after we spoke about these issues. He said, silence is not just golden, silence is the golden calf. So let's trace, take it from the beginning. And I have a simple question. Is that the story of the golden calf in this week's parsha is followed with Moshe's reactions and then followed by the death of 3,000 people. Right? Moshe reacts very violently to this. According to Ramban, he was an uncontrollable reaction, sort of like when he hit the rock after his sister died and Bnei Yisrael didn't give him a moment's rest to mourn for her, and they complained about the water. Or also Ramban compares it to Moshe beating the Egyptian. He said he did not think of what he was doing. He just had to do something to save this person. So Moshe uncontrollably broke the luchos. He just didn't have gotten to a rage, and then he broke them. Some other commentaries say Moshe, in a cool and collective manner, grabbed the luchos and felt he had to teach his people a lesson that you cannot instill anything physical with the inherent holiness of God. That they were directing their worship to God through this golden calf in his absence. And he felt cool and collectively, he broke the luchos in order to teach them that nothing can contain inherent holiness, even these tablets that God himself just made. So this was meant to be a teachable moment for them so that he would destroy this golden calf, which of course could not be inherently holy. And according to Rashbam, he accidentally broke the luchos. They just fell out of his hands. He had to push them so they wouldn't fall on his feet. So Rashbam is largely and widely considered in the scholarly world to have been polemicizing against Christians who taught that the broken luchos was a harbinger for a broken covenant. But be that as it may, Moshe reacted. And then, after 3,000 people died, the Gemara says there were three different groups of people: people who were seen to have worshipped, who were killed in a judgment; people who were not seen to have worshipped, who were killed by the drink that Moshe forced them to drink from the dust of the calf that was ground into dust. And that is one is a story where he asks the tribe of Levi to come go about and wreak vengeance. And after all of that, 3,000 people died. And this is actually, in terms of terrible trespasses in the desert, a relatively small number. There were other events in the desert where many more than that amount were killed. But let's put that aside for the moment and say that after 3,000 people were killed, the very next verse, Moshe says, Atem chatosem chato'o gedola. You have sinned a great sin. So my first question is, why turn to the survivors and tell the survivors, you've sinned a great sin? Surely the people who sinned a great sin in making the golden calf were punished when they were killed. 3,000 people certainly did something a lot worse than the 2,997,000 survivors. So why does Moshe only speak about a sin after those 3,000 people died, reminding the survivors, Atem chatosem chata'o gedola? Another question is that Chazal say that there is a ritual in the Torah that serves as atonement for the golden calf. Rashi mentions it very often. And he actually says that the golden calf was given before this. It's probably a printer's error. He meant kibud av va'em. Chaf aleph became pei aleph. Pe'alef became Parah Aduma. But the Parah Aduma, according to Rashi, was a result of the golden calf. And the question I ask is, how is the Parah Aduma, is the red heifer that atones for death defilement, how is that atonement for the Egel? And then I stress the question I asked already. Why does the Egel still need atonement? The people who worshipped it were killed, the Gemara says, in three different groups. And an offshoot of this question is, in Parshas Chukas, where the story of the Parah Aduma appears, so the Gemara is there, the Medrash there says that Parshas Chukas, and Rashi brings down this Medrash, is called Chukas, Zos Chukas HaTorah, because the story of the Parah Aduma, the all the halachos of the Parah Aduma defies logic. And after Rashi says that it's called Chukas because you're not supposed to ask any questions about the nature of the red heifer, purifying death defilement, you're not supposed to ask any questions about this. And then after the whole story of the Parah Aduma, Rashi goes about line by line for a long time. It's a very long Rashi, explaining the Parah Aduma, the red heifer, in light of every single detail of the ritual of Parah Aduma as atonement for the Egel. Now, if the Parah Aduma is atonement for the Egel, it does not defy logic. It's perfectly logical. Only Rashi doesn't tell us how and why. Or why does the Egel still need kapara? 3,000 people died and stuff finished. Why does it still need atonement? What is it about the Parah Aduma that atones for the Egel? And to answer that, we go back to Rashi's first comment. He said that the red heifer defies logic. So on that, at least we have a Gemara for this. On Daf Yudal, the Amud Aleph, and the Maseches Yuma, the Gemara says that there is an aspect of the red heifer that defied the wisdom even of Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, the wisest of all. And he said, Amarti ech kema v'hi rechoka mimeni. I'm trying to be smart, but it's too distant for me. I cannot explain through wisdom, through anything involving chokhmah, the secrets of the Parah Aduma. And the Gemara says, what was it that so confounded the wisest man? It's that mitameh tahor u'mitaher tameh. That's how the Gemara presents it. That in the efforts of purifying a death-defiled man, a death-defiled person, the one who is sprinkling the water from the ashes of the Parah Aduma, that's all mixed together, that in the efforts of sprinkling and receiving divine purification, that the one who does it becomes himself tamei. You get it? It's used mitaher tamei. He is in the process of purifying someone who is impure, and such an act makes him impure. It's mitamei hatahor. So that confounded Shlomo HaMelech, said the Gemara. And this is back to Rashi, who said that the Parah Aduma defies logic and we're not allowed to ask about it. So I reiterate the question, so why does Rashi tell us what it is, namely an atonement for the golden calf? And furthermore, I might ask, what is so illogical about this fact? What did Shlomo find so confounding? It is physiologically sound to consider that something that can make someone who is impure, to make that person pure, and it might have the exact opposite effect on a person who is pure. I think that this is medically sound. Something something that is good would make one person to be healthy might make another person to be very sick. Life-saving chemotherapy may make a cancer patient well and cured, and the same chemotherapy may make a well person very sick. So why is it so confounding to Shlomo that the purification waters that will make a spiritually ill person, that will make a spiritually ill person to be well, might make a spiritually well person to be ill? In other words, it takes someone who's tamei and it makes him tahor. And it makes someone, and that very act makes the tahor person to be tamei. That simply makes sense. It makes sense physiologically. So what confounded Shlomo HaMelech? That is the introduction to this presentation, and the answer to all these questions will be that silence is the golden calf. Now, I just want to complicate things a little further, right? Because our sages say that there is one other mitzvah of the Torah that atones for the golden calf. Okay, you can stay. Okay, I'm sorry for a moment.
Yes.
Can you stay? I'm giving a share on Zoom. Double park. Okay. Thank you. Sorry about this. Okay. So to complicate things further, Chazal say that another mitzvah of the Torah atones for the golden calf. Anyone like to, venture what that might be? Not only does the red heifer atone for the golden calf, but the mitzvah of Egla Arufa also atones for the golden calf. Now, that's a little easier to understand. One's an Egel and one's an Egla, right? They're calves. The Paraduma is the calf's mother, is the cow, right? So it seems, according to Chazal, that any mitzvah involving a cow can theoretically be atonement for the golden calf. What is the mitzvah of Egla Rufa? You have to describe the details of the Egla Rufa. Is that the Torah says at the end of Parashas Shoftim that if a person is found in mysterious manner to, there's no foul play or anything, the person is found to have died in between two cities. He didn't drown. If he drowned, you don't do this. If he drowned, we know how he died. But he's found to have been killed in between two cities. And he's dead. So the elders of the two cities closest to him, and he take the two cities closest to him. They measure. They have to measure. And they see which city is closer. The elders of the closer city have to perform a ritual known as Egla Arufa to atone for this dead person. Gemara asks, what do the elders have to atone? Is there anyone who thinks that one of the elders killed this man? And the Gemara says, possibly, because maybe this man asked for lodgings, he asked for help, he asked for some safety in this town, and he was denied. No one took him in. The elders are responsible for that. If you live in a place where someone can possibly ask for help and doesn't get any, then the elders of that city are responsible. And they have to take a calf, a young calf, that never did work, never lifted anything, never plowed, never did. It's a young calf. It probably didn't plow. It's very young. It didn't, but it didn't carry anything. And he has to take it to a piece of land. It's called Nachal Eitan, Eretz Gezeira, place where nothing can grow. A place where where it's so rocky and jagged that plants can't grow there, and plants have never grown there as far as they know. And they take this calf and break its neck, not from the front like all other kachim, all other sacrifices. This animal is sacrificed from the neck, the back of the neck. Break its neck from the back. And the Gemara actually at the end of Maseches Sota gives various symbols of all this. Break its neck because the elders turn their back on this man. The animal could never have worked and never drawn a burden because this poor man died without being able to produce anything. And these, what do you have elders for? They're supposed to be there to help strangers like this. So you act in passivity. You didn't help this man. The land could never have been sown because the land didn't produce anything. The animal didn't produce anything. So this is the atonement, says the Gemara, for the golden calf. So what is that? I ask, why does the golden calf still need atonement? And now, with the Egla Rufa, we can start to answer the questions. Because the sin of the elders was the sin of passivity. The elders should have set up a system whereby nothing like this could ever take place. We're blaming it on the elders. You should have had a welcoming committee. You should have a goodwill building right outside the town that takes care of people who have no place to go. This is the role of the elders. And if someone could possibly, chas v'shalom, die right outside your town, then you are culpable. So here is the first explanation, the first question. This is a notation of passivity. I don't mean to say I might say the same thing today, but when in the time of King David, after he killed Goliath, Gemara in Yevamos says that the king Saul denied David the opportunity to fulfill his promise, whoever kills this giant gets to marry my daughter, but that the king balked at this, didn't give over his daughter Merav for David, because at first he was bewildered that I can't give my daughter to this man because his great-grandmother was a Moabite. And Moabites are not allowed to join the Kehillah. Says Lo Yavo Amoni Moavi Bikal Hashem. So if his great grandmother was a Moabite, I'm giving my daughter to the halachic equivalent of a mamzer. Can't give my daughter over to a descendant of a Moabite. Now this posed quite the quandary to Shmuel, who had already crowned him king. How can we have a future king that isn't allowed to marry a Jewish woman? Can't have that. So Shmuel is at a quandary, and God told him, according to the Gemara, I want you to do some research, look back at this great-grandmother of his, and write a story about her. Write the fact that there were people at the time who agreed with that they can't marry her, penashchisis nachlosi. I can't perpetuate the name of my cousin Machlon, because marrying his wife will destroy my inheritance and make my children to have a halachic equivalent of a mamzer. So why was Boaz willing to marry her? Because Boaz established, we say established because it wasn't known by the masses. It wasn't even known in Shaul's time. But the Gemara explains that the reason why we exclude Ammon and Moab from joining our Kehillah and marrying Jewish women, marrying Jews, is because they didn't greet us with bread and water as we left Egypt. Right? Now, God could have supplied us with a billion bottles of Poland Spring and lots of sandwiches So we wouldn't need any help from anybody. But that's not how God works. God sees need and wants other people to fulfill that need. Yes, God could give us give it all the food in the universe and a cure for every disease, but God wants human agency in doing these things. So when we have a nation that's so close to us, that owes its existence again and again to Avraham, the sons of Lot, Ammon and Moab, should have been the first in line to give us food and water when we left Egypt. And because they didn't, only they are punished. Only they are punished. Other nation, no nation gave us bread and water when we left Egypt. By that measure, no one should ever be allowed to join our Kehillah and convert. Rather, only Ammon and Moab are punished for not giving us bread and water. So then the question is begged. So Boaz, why were you willing to marry Ruth? She's a Moabite. So Boaz argued, and the argument held the day there. Boaz argued that we only punish the men of Moab for not greeting us with bread and water. It's only Avraham who went out to greet the strangers, not Sarah, who was in the tent. But it's not the way of the women to go out to do that. So don't punish the women for not doing what you wouldn't expect them to do in the first place. Even for women to go out and greet women, after all, the angels were men. But even that's not expected. It's not the way of women to go out to greet strangers at that time in history. I might say something different today, but at that time, I don't mean to be taken out of context. 3,300 years ago, femininity denoted passivity, which is why Moshe, for the only time that a sin is called a chata'ah, is in Parshas Kisisa, in the context of the golden calf. Because everybody behaved with passivity and watched as 3,000 people did a cardinal sin. And they said, I'm not going to get involved. Let them, all right, they want to sin. 3,000 people, that's 1 in 1,000. 999 out of every 1,000 Jews at that time decided, I'm not making myself impure to stop them. I'm not going to do any of that. Let them do what they want. There's a mitzvah in the Torah, Hochech Tochech Zamisecha. Reprove people who are doing something wrong. But these people said, nah, let them be. I don't want to fushmutz myself to help them. So 2,997,000 people sinned in a way that needs atonement. And Moshe said, Naratem chatosem chait gadol. But Moshe made up a new word that hadn't appeared yet. Atem chatosem chata'a gidola. You've sinned a great sin. And that was the sin of passivity. What's interesting is that in the parsha of Egla Rufa, it says, Yodenu lo shafchu, our hands did not spill this blood of this man who died nearby. We're not responsible. Right? Even though the Talmud says you are. So it puts in, Yodenu lo shafchu. You ever see the way shafchu is spelled in the Masorah? Shin pei chaf hei, the kubutz. Not a shuruk. Shin pei chaf hei. As if to underscore this same point, is that the elders behaved just like the people, the 2,997,000 who watched 3,000, just a small, tiny percentage, 0.1% of the population changed our history. Because 99.9% of the population refused to do anything about it. So how does the Parah Aduma atone for this? The answer is Avas Yisrael. We atone for it by making a mitzvah. There's a mitzvah. Some man has to step forward and take that cruse of Parah Aduma ashes and water and make himself Tameh to help someone else become Tahar. Now, what happens if every Kohen in the whole world says, I'm not doing that? I have a korban coming up. It's my week of work in the service in the Beis HaMikdash. I'm not doing that. I don't want to have the inconvenience of being tummy for a week. I've got work to do. I'm not making myself tummy to help make that person tahor. So here comes the Torah and says, you don't have the option of doing that. You have a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah. It's true, people do have the option of opting out of mitzvahs, but you would be an abarion. You'd be behaving just like those people at the golden calf, and you'll be shunned. The Gemara says people jumped at the opportunity to make themselves tamei, to help make someone else tahor, because that's the secret. It's known as Avas Yisrael. The secret of Avas Yisrael is Parah Aduma. To look out for the other. To not be concerned. I know, I want to help that person become Torah, but I know I'm going to become Tameh as a result. The fact that the Torah holds us responsible to do this, this is the explanation of Parah Aduma. Bamidbar Rabba says, Medrash in Parshas Chukah says that while Shlomo was correct, Amarti ech kema v'hiruchokam imeni, I tried to be smart and I couldn't figure out what Parah Aduma means. But the Medrash says the Navi, through Nevuah, through Chochmah, you can't figure out Parah Aduma because it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to command someone to become Tameh while helping someone else become Tohar. Ah, but Nevuah understands it. The Torah isn't only Chochmah. The Torah is morality. The Torah is Nevuah. The Navi can explain Parah Aduma. Because that's what the Navi does. The Navi would surely rather be in the Beis Medrash. The Navi would rather be doing mitzvahs. Instead, what does the Navi do? He makes himself disparaging to all the people by trying to get them to be better. And they hate him. Right? The Nevi'im had very miserable existences in the Tanakh. Eliyahu was scourged. Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, Yeshayahu, all beaten and put in stocks and jailed. That's what the Navi does. The Navi would rather just kovesh nevuaso and just call it a day. But he knows his responsibility. He has the ecstasy of communion with God. Then he has to go and make his people better. The Navi can explain Parah Aduma. The Chacham maybe can't. Because it doesn't make much sense. And then Boaz becomes famous for going out on a limb for the sake of this wonderful Balas Chesed named Ruth. Ploni Almoni, who refuses, behaves like Shaul, who wants to invalidate David. So he didn't want to perpetuate Mahlon's name, so the Tanakh doesn't perpetuate his name. We just call him John Doe, Ploni Almoni. So the Navi can explain everything about the Parah Aduma and everything about the Eglah Rufa. And the Navi can explain that this is why Moshe turned not to the 3,000 worshippers. They don't need atonement. They got the atonement. They were killed. He turns to the survivors who didn't want to do anything about it. And he tells them, Atem chata sem chata agidola. But I'm going to give you Yom Kippur to atone. I'm going to give you Parah Aduma to atone. Yom Kippur amazingly also has an aspect of mitameh tohar, mitaher tameh, that someone in the efforts of bringing atonement, bringing purity, bringing forgiveness to his people, the Gemara in Maseches Yuma says that the person who pushes off the goat from the Azazel cliff, he becomes tummy when doing so. And still, they jumped at the opportunity to do it. You might argue, maybe so. Everyone will say, why should I make myself tummy to help someone else become tahor? That's his problem. No, says the halacha. No, says Nevuah. And that's why Yom Kippur, which is the date of Moshe finally bringing home the good news to Bnei Yisrael, that that they are forgiven for the Egel is the anniversary that they have our atonement, the 10th of Tishrei. So we got the good news that God forgave us for the Egel, and God allows us to turn our things around. So I want to continue now with a description of a Maamar Chazal that's amazingly says that Yom Kippurim is a Yom Kippurim. Yom Kippur that we celebrate, that we commemorate on the 10th of Tishrei, is a day like Purim. Now, that is absurd. One day we're fasting, one day we're feasting. One day we're not drinking, another day we're drinking not only liquids, but we're drinking hard liquids, right? One day is filled with boisterous celebrations, one day is filled with solemnity. And yet, the Mishnah at the end of Maseches Tainis says that Yom Kippur is one of the two happiest days of the year. What's the other day? Anybody know? Hint, it's not Purim.
Yes, yeah, 4x4x4.
Tuba'av is correct. Tuba'av because of Shiduchim, where we find our true place in life. And the other one is Yom Kippur because the Gemara gives two reasons, because of the forgiveness and because of the presentation of oral law that led to joy. We won't get into that second reason right now. It's enough to say that we're forgiven. That may be how we're like Purim. Purim is v'nahafochu. Purim is a last-minute reprieve that can take us from the worst situation to the best situation. We're facing annihilation by Haman's decree, and just in a moment, that's deus ex machina in the Greek theater. It's like out of nowhere, the salvation comes, and now Haman is hanging from a tree with his 10 sons. The whole story is v'nahafochu. In the beginning of the story, the king's best friend convinces him to kill the queen. At the end of the story, the queen convinces him to kill his best friend. That's v'nahafochu. That's the nature of the Jewish experience in the diaspora, where we are not responsible for our own destiny. We're not accountable for our own destiny. The whole essence of Zionism, of return to Israel, is that now we can determine our own destiny. So this is what is changing in the Purim story. So, but that's on a simple level. V'nahafochu is that Yom Kippur has the power to turn things around considerably for me. And that's what Purim did. It turned things around profoundly. However, Rav Soloveitchik Zal explains this in a much deeper level. It's interesting that we always talk about going to a Purim Seuda. We're going for Purim to family, right? But it would be very interesting to translate into Persian what that means. Right? Where are you having your lots meal this year? Right? You going home to family for a lottery? Purim is a lottery, is a lot. It's okay to transliterate the name of the holiday, but if we translated it, it would, wouldn't hold the same weight. So what is it about the fact that Haman used a lottery system to determine which day to kill the Jews? He put 12 names of months in one hat, 30 days in another hat, and to say, 13, okay, I'll kill them on the 13th. Which month? Adar, okay, 13th of Adar, let's kill them. Well, how does that fact of determining the day to kill the Jews create the name of the holiday? I would have called the holiday Chag Esther or something like that. What is Purim? What is the nature of Purim, of the lottery? So if Soloveitchik said that, don't forget that the lottery is an important aspect of Yom Kippur too. It's a goral. Yipil pur hua goral. That word appears in the Yom Kippur service of Parshas Hacharemos. the main service of the day was how the Kohen Gadol chose between two goats that go for almost exactly the opposite destiny. One goes Kadosh Lashem, it's holy unto God, and the other one has all the sins of Israel placed between its horns to be shoved off a cliff. And the Mishnah says in Maseches Yuma, the sixth parak, that the two goats have to be exactly alike in size, in value, in dimension, and one has a black mark one place, the other has to have a black mark in the same place. They have to be exactly alike, mamish, like identical twins. And what determines the fact that they go for profoundly different destinies? The capricious lot. Capricious, I add, means a goat in Latin. Right? Capricious means unstable, unpredictable. The goat is very unpredictable. So perhaps the English word from the Latin, you know, can literally mean like a goat. Right? Like the goat of Yom Kippur, where the determining factor of these exact opposite destinies is something as debilitatingly capricious as the lot. Kohelet seems to point us in this direction when he speaks about man being helpless like a fish or a bird in a net. What pit'om, suddenly. We're riding high, everything is going well, but so suddenly things can change. And that's how suddenly things change for the good for us. But they can also change for the bad right away with another bad king named Antiochus or you name it. Until we have our own land, we are always dependent on Vayakam Melech Chadash, on the decrees of a new king or a new advisor. We have to start taking control of ourselves. And the Yom Kippurim service of these two goats being chosen in opposite directions by the capricious lot is true not only of our national condition in the Galus, but also of our personal condition. Even though I feel healthy, I still prayed this morning, Refa'inu Hashem v'nei Rafei. Even though I have something of a parnasa, I still said, Baruch Aleinu Hashem Elokeinu es Hashanah Hazos. Not only for others who need these things, but for the maintenance. It should make us humble. Nothing is a guarantee for us. Our lives are sometimes holding in the balance. And we require a daily infusion of faith to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to maintain what we have. And we stand before God on Yom Kippur and say, God, I don't mean to make excuses. You know the human condition. That's why you're so lenient with us and so generous with us. You know the human condition. You know how my life could have been very different under very slightly different conditions. You know that the 100,000 things in my early years went into making me what I am. I'm just asking you for another year. I may be here next year making all the same excuses, but I'm here in Yom Kippur looking at these two goats in the Beis HaMikdash, where one goes to be holy unto you, which is where I want to go. Don't let me go to Azazel. Don't shove me off a cliff. Help me here. I'm going to do as best as I can. This is how Rav Soloveitchik explained how Yom Kippurim is a Yom Kippurim involving a goral, involving chance events. But I'm going to take responsibility as much as I can. Even the story of Yonah has a goral aspect to it, where Yonah fails to take responsibility and act on what he should. So this is all part of what Yom Kippur means to us. Yonah chooses the easy way out, just to escape. The 2,997,000 people watching 3,000 people worship an Egel, 1 in 1,000 took the easy way out. So Yonah just figures, let me escape. I don't want to be the one responsible for the rehabilitation of Nineveh, the capital city of Ashur, who are going to exile my people 80 years from now. let me not go down in history as the one who rehabilitated them. So he escapes and he sets in motion just that. Had Yonah done the responsible thing and just did what God wanted him to do to give the people of Nineveh a chance, they probably would not have listened to this Hebrew telling them to make their lives better. The king would say, who's this Hebrew telling us what to do? But as it turns out, he set in motion the events where the sailors saw the storm subside as soon as they threw him overboard, and other ships saw the same thing. Everyone was abuzz about what had happened there. It was all over social media back home in Nineveh. And when he shows up alive in 3 days, they were willing to listen to him. So Yonah, while you're busy getting them to do tshuva, why didn't you put a little more heart into it than just to say 5 words? Once you were convinced to do so by inside the whale, why didn't you make a greater effort perhaps to make them do tshuva to the extent that they won't exile your people 80 years from now? But as it is, you do go down into history as the one who rehabilitated them, because you took the easy way out. You just thought to escape. Chevra, let us not escape. Let's be ready to make ourselves tummy, even if it means, you know, to help someone else become tahor, even if it means making ourselves tummy. Otherwise, we run the risk of making the same mistake of the people at the Egel. Now you can see it. People say silence is golden. No, silence is the golden calf. Silence helped create the golden calf.
90 exactly.
Okay, excuse me, I'm sorry. Someone just came into my...
Highly appreciate it. 90 exactly.
This evening. This evening. Okay, good. Okay, good. Come on, Zoom.
Highly appreciate it.
Okay.
90 exactly.
I'm sorry, I don't have a... Okay, just... So, the Egel worshippers are finally forgiven on their atonement, is what happened to 3,000 of them. The passive ones were forgiven on Yom Kippur. So that connects to the Parah Aduma. It connects to the Egel Arufa. It connects to why we still needed atonement after the Egel. And now this may be why Rashi started off Parshas Chukas by saying there is no understanding of this Parsha. Even Shlomo couldn't understand it. Why is Rashi saying that? Because Chazal say that the Egel Arufa and the Parah Aduma atones for the Egel. Rashi must have wondered, why does the Egel need atonement? Because the fact that the Torah feels it can command people to make themselves tamei in the efforts of making someone else tahor. Rashi says the fact that the Parah Aduma still atones for the Egel, that's what makes the Parah Aduma so hard to understand. Doesn't make sense to force someone to make himself tamei to make someone else Torah. But that's the Torah. That's Avas Yisrael. That's Nevuah. It may not be so Chochmah, right? But it's Nevuah. So now I close with a story in the Talmud. The Daf Yomi is going to read this story just in a little more than 2 weeks. And it's a story of Rabbi Akiva, who came to visit his Rebbe, Rabbi Eliezer, while he was very sick. And he came with 3 friends. The other 3 friends were all crying and saying over psukim and saying over different ideas of how upset they are and how the world is suffering because Rabbi Eliezer is sick. And they're all kissing up to their Rebbe. Rabbi Akiva comes in, as he often does, and he starts laughing. And he's saying how happy he is to see his Rebbe suffering. So Rabbi Eliezer pulls himself up in his bed and he says, Akiva, what's making you so happy here? So Rabbi Akiva answers, He says that, Rebbe, I saw that you have had such a perfect life so far. Everything you touch always succeeds. You have the most amount of students. Your Torah is perfect. You have the best reputation. This must have been before he was put into Cherem. But your reputation is perfect. I'm worried that you're eating all of your peros, all of your reward in this world. Now that I see that you're suffering now, here in this world, that gives me joy to know that when you die, you'll go straight to the Olam Haba without any need for any atonement. So that gives me joy. That's why I'm laughing. So Rabbi Eliezer pulls himself up further in bed and he says, Akiva, can you tell me what I've done in this world to deserve this level of punishment, this level of suffering? Rabbi Akiva's answer is astonishing. He said, Limadatenu Rabbeinu, now I quote, Limadatenu Rabbeinu, you taught us, Rabbi, Ki Adam Ein Tzadik Ba'aretz Asher Yaseh Tov Lo Yechta. Everybody sins, Rabbi, take it on the chin. If you're suffering, you must have sinned. And if you sinned, you should be happy that you're getting your atonement for that sin. That's the end of the story. There are so many questions on this. One, you're not allowed to talk to even a student this way. Surely you shouldn't talk to a Rebbe this way. There's a Mishnah in Maseches Bav Metzia that says that if you tell a suffering person that he is suffering for his sins, that is an avera of the Torah known as Ona'at Dvarim. You are abusing that person. You are afflicting that person with words. And it is the behavior of Eov's three friends with Eov. God told those three friends at the end of the book, you've sinned a great sin. If Eov doesn't pray for you, you will all die because you did not judge him favorably. So if the Mishnah says that to tell someone he's sinning for his own sins, the Gemara quotes Psukim from Eov. If you tell a person that he's sinning for his own sins, Hanosh me'eloi yitzdok, right? And you say that I'd rather have man be judged than to have God be judged. So if you behave this way, then you are behaving like Eov's three friends, and you are over on Onas Devarim. So how does Rabbi Akiva engage in Onas Devarim against a Rebbe? Second question. Why does he say, Limadatenu Rabbeinu? Rebbe, you taught us that everybody sins. This is a pasuk. It's a verse in the book of Koheles. You should have said, Rebbe, halo ksiv. Rebbe, doesn't it say in Koheles that everybody sins? So take it on the chin. Right, that may be nitpicking, but still it's a question. Why did he say you taught us this pasuk? You didn't teach us. Shlomo taught us this pasuk. Okay. Third question. There is a tradition in Chazal that four people never sin. Have you ever heard of this tradition? Right? There's a tradition in Chazal that Binyamin, Ben Yaakov, Amram, father of Moshe, Yishai, father of David, Kilav, brother of Shlomo. There is a tradition that these four people never sinned. So how did they die if they never sinned? The answer is, death is a decree upon man from the time of Adam HaRishon, so they had to die. So notice that the Gemara identifies them. I know who Binyamin is. You don't have to tell me he's the son of Yaakov or the brother of Yosef. I know who Amram is, and you don't have to tell me he's the father of Moshe. I know that Yishai is the father of David and that Kilav is the brother of Shlomo. Why are you telling me all this? The answer is that the Torah, that the Gemara wants to identify these four perfect, guiltless people who never sin with four much more righteous people than they are. Much more righteous. I'd rather have Yosef than Binyamin. I'd rather have Moshe than Amram. I'd rather have David than Yishai, and I'd rather have Shlomo than Kilav on my biblical dream team. Why does the Gemara identify them with the four? For this, I think for this very reason. The reason why Yosef was a greater tzaddik, he's known as Yosef HaTzaddik, is because he was out there in the world. Yes, you can go a whole lifetime without sinning, but that's only if you're hiding away in your own skin. You're hiding in a cave someplace. You're not making yourself felt. You're not sprinkling water on a paraduma because you're afraid of being sinful yourself. When Avram was praying for the wicked people of Sodom, he said, "Ulayesh chamishim tzadikim besocha ir." Not ulayesh chamishim tzadikim sham. Maybe there are 50 righteous people there. 45, 40, 20, 30, 20, 10. He said, "Ulayesh chamishim tzadikim besocha ir." God, if there are 50 righteous people in the midst of the city, even Ibn Ezra says this, then it's very possible, it's very likely that those 50 people will get their word out. And they'll help make the whole rest of them turn to tzaddikim too. They'll see the light. But if you have 50 tzaddikim or 1,000 tzaddikim and they're not besocha ir, I don't care. Do what you have to. But if they're besocha ir, God, give them a chance. Let's see. And that's why Yirmiyahu in chapter 5 of his book said, Shotetu b'chutzos Yerushalayim. God said, find me one righteous person in the midst of the city of Yerushalayim, and I'll forgive Jerusalem. Obviously, God did not find that person. Aye, there were many righteous people in Yerushalayim at the time. It says in Tehillim chapter 79 that the Babylonians wiped out all the Hasidim, all the Avdei Hashem, all the Tzaddikim. Why didn't they save Yerushalayim? The answer is they weren't bechutzos. They weren't outside. They weren't getting their point across. Right? They weren't getting their word out. Right? And that's what Rabbi Akiva was telling his Rebbe. Limadetenu Rabbeinu. I know it's a pasuk. You know it's a pasuk. Everybody knows it's a pasuk. But this is what you taught us. You taught us to make a diuk in the pasuk. Ki adam ein tzadik ba'aretz asher yaseh tov lo yechta. There is no righteous man in the land who goes a whole life without sinning. Why did he have to put the word in the land there? You mean you could live in a tree and not sin? You could live in the ocean and not sin? What's the point of saying man cannot live in the land and go without sinning? Because if you're living in the land, unlike Binyamin, unlike Amram, unlike Yishai and Kilav, if you look in rabbinic literature on these four, they're extremely passive individuals compared to their much more righteous relatives. But as a result of being out there in the world, they sinned. Yes, they committed sins. Yeah, Yosef was not perfect. Moshe was not perfect. David and Shlomo were not perfect. Not as perfect as their relatives who went the whole life without sinning. It's very easy to do that if you're not Ba'aretz. It's very easy to do that if you're not Bechutzos Yerushalayim. It's very easy to do that if you're not Besocha Ir. Right? That's what Paraduma asks of us. To be ready to give up of ourselves if it means making someone else Tahor. That's what Nevuah does. And Nevuah understands Paraduma for that reason. And that's why Moshe held responsible those 2,997,000 for not doing more to help those 3,000. That, I submit to you, is why silence is the golden calf. And we have to spend every Yom Kippur. Torah says that every Yom Kippur, there's a little piece of the egel that we have to be reminded of. Because after all, Adam Korov Latzmo, we're born very selfish. Yetzolev Adam Raminu Rav. We're born selfish. We don't know any other way. We're not born evil, but we're born selfish. We have to be taught by good parents and good teachers to share. And to think of that there's another person out there, that there are others. That is the secret of Paraduma. That is the Avas Yisrael that we're speaking of here. That was our saving grace in the Purim story where we're all unified. Lech Kenosas Kol HaYehudim. We came together. And all of this comes at a convenient time, Purim time, very precarious time for us. But we know that in God's beautiful world, the Ben Hafochu is always, always a possibility. That just 3 years after the worst time for the Jewish nation in 2,000 years, just 3 years later was the best time for the Jewish nation in 2,000 years. And that Ben Hafochu is always right around the corner for us. We just have to deserve God's graces. And we hope that Asher Yishlatu Ayehudim Hema B'Soneihem, that the evil that Haman represented, which was replicated many times in our history, but what Amalek is, what Haman is, these are examples of the hatred that is so deep, they're willing to harm themselves more if they could only harm us along the way. That's their plan. So Chevra, we know the antidote to all this, to be Ba'aretz, be Bezhochair, to be Chutzos Yerushalayim, to help others, to be the shoulder that the people in that city close to the Egla Rufa city wasn't for that man, to be that person, to make sure that we are there for others in need. That is the antidote. And I wish you all a Simchas Purim, an easy rest of the fast. Thank you all for joining me in this hour of learning, and went very fast. And let's hope that we see Yeshua's Benachamos.
Thank you.
Well, everybody.
I love what you said.
Thank you very much.
I love what you said. Is it possible that we wear masks on Purim in order to be able to express our opinions?
To wear masks on Purim is... So you want to say it's, we should have no inhibition, that no one should know who's saying the words that I'm saying? Is that...
That's what I'm suggesting. That's why, yes. That's why Yosef changed the clothes of his brothers before letting them leave Egypt.
As always, Rabbi Heppner, you always have a chiddush, and always have a wrinkle that always makes everything that people say to be one step better. I just want to thank you because your son is laning the Megillah all over the place today, and thank you for inspiring him the way you do.
Thank you so much indeed.
Okay, I wish you all the best.
Rabbi Schwartz, Richie Alman, how are you?
That sounds like Richie Alman. How are you?
How are you? Quick question, not on the topic. We were in Israel and met someone who's done extensive research on Pshat of Rashi, and he would like to discuss it with you. Is there a way that he can contact you?
Sure. Can I give you a number right now, and you can call that number anytime.
Great.
212.
Uh-huh.
749.
Uh-huh.
5150.
Great.
Extension 200 is that's my shul number.
Hi, it's Sharon. How are you?
Hi, Sharon. Baruch Hashem.
Special regards to the family.
Yeah.
Baruch Hashem.
Thank you. I will most certainly send it, and I'm sure that Lisa would want me to send it right back to you.
Great. Baruch Hashem. Chag Sameach, Purim Sameach, and Shabbat Shalom. All the best.
All the best.
All too, everyone. Be well.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach, everyone. Be well. Chag Sameach. All too, Jack. Chag Sameach, Jack. All too.